going on. I doubt if she does, the man in the dark blue Botany 500 suit said. He spoke with great sincerity. You didn't see them leave?
No, sir. Far as I know, they're still around here somewhere. Unless their flight's been called, of course.
10. The two men made a quick sweep through the main terminal and then through the boarding gates, holding their IDs up in their cupped hands for the security cops to see. They met near the United Airlines ticket desk.
Dry, the first said.
Think they took a plane? The second asked.
He was the fellow in the nice blue Botany 500.
I don't think that bastard had more than 50 bucks to his name. Maybe a whole lot less than that.
We better check it.
Yeah, but quick.
United Airlines, Allegheny, American, Braniff, the commuter airlines. No broad-shouldered man who looked sick had bought tickets. The baggage handler at Albany Airlines thought he had seen a little girl in red pants and a green shirt, though. Pretty blonde hair, shoulder length. The two of them met again near the TV chairs where Andy and Charlie had been sitting not long ago.
What do you think? The first asked.
The agent in the Botany 500 looked excited.
I think we ought to blanket the area, he said. I think they're on foot.
They headed back to the green car, almost trotting. 11. Andy and Charlie walked on through the dark along the soft shoulder of the airport feeder road. An occasional car swept by them. It was almost 1 o'clock. A mile behind them, in the terminal, the two men had rejoined their third partner at the green car. Andy and Charlie were now walking parallel to the northway, which was to their right and below them, lit by the depthless glare of sodium lights. It might be possible to scramble down the embankment and try to thumb a ride in the breakdown lane, but if a cop came along, that would end whatever poor chance they still had to get away. Andy was wondering how far they would have to walk before they came to a ramp. Each time his foot came down, it generated a thud that resounded sickly in his head.
"Daddy, are you still okay?"
"So far so good," he said, but he was not so very okay. He wasn't fooling himself, and he doubted if he was fooling Charlie.
"How much further is it?"
"Are you getting tired?"
"Not yet, but Daddy..."
He stopped and looked solemnly down at her.
"What is it, Charlie?"
"I feel like those bad men are around again," she whispered.
"All right," he said. "I think we better just take a shortcut, honey. Can you get down that hill without falling?"
She looked at the grade, which was covered with dead October grass.
"I guess so," she said doubtfully.
He stepped over the guardrail cables and then helped Charlie over. As it sometimes did in moments of extreme pain and stress, his mind attempted to flee into the past, to get away from the stress. There had been some good years, some good times, before the shadow began to steal gradually over their lives, first just over him and Vicky, then over all three, blotting out their happiness a little at a time, as inexorably as a lunar eclipse. It had been...
"Daddy!"
Charlie called in sudden alarm. She had lost her footing. The dry grass was slippery, treacherous. Andy grabbed for her flailing arm, missed, and overbalanced himself. The thud as he hit the ground caused such pain in his head that he cried out loud. Then they were both rolling and sliding down the embankment toward the northway where the cars rushed past, much too fast to stop if one of them, he or Charlie, should tumble out onto the pavement.
12.
The GA looped a piece of rubber flex around Andy's arm just above the elbow and said, "Make a fist, please." Andy did. The vein popped up obligingly. He looked away, feeling a little ill. $200 or not, he had no urge to watch the IV set in place. Vicky Tomlinson was on the next cot, dressed in a sleeveless white blouse and dove gray slacks. She offered him a strained smile. He thought again what beautiful auburn hair she had, how well it went with her direct blue eyes. Then the prick of pain, followed by dull heat in his arm.
"There," the grad assistant said comfortingly.
"There yourself," Andy said. He was not comforted. They were in room 70 of Jacent Gearney Hall, upstairs. A dozen cots had been trucked in, courtesy of the college infirmary, and the 12 volunteers were lying propped up on hypoallergenic foam pillows, earning their money. Dr. Wanless started none of the IVs himself, but he was walking up and down between the cots with a word for everyone and a little frosty smile. "We'll start to shrink any time now," Andy thought morbidly.
Wanless had made a brief speech when they were all assembled, and what he had said, when boiled down, amounted to, "Do not fear. You are wrapped snugly in the arms of modern science." Andy had no great faith in modern science, which had given the world the H-bomb, napalm, and the laser rifle, along with the Salk vaccine and Clearasil. The grad assistant was doing something else now, crimping the IV line. The IV drip was 5% dextrose in water. Wanless had said what he called a D5W solution. Below the crimp, a small tip poked out of the IV line. If Andy got lot 6, it would be administered by a syringe through the tip. If he was in the control group, it would be normal saline. Heads or tails? He glanced over at Vicky again. How you doing, kid?
Okay.
Wanless had arrived. He stood between them, looking first at Vicky and then at Andy. You feel some slight pain, yes? He had no accent of any kind, least of all a regional American one, but he constructed his sentences in a way Andy associated with English learned as a second language. Pressure, Vicky said. Slight pressure. Yes, it will pass.
He smiled benevolently down at Andy.
In his white lab coat, he seemed very tall. His glasses seemed very small. The small and the tall. Andy said, when do we start to shrink? Wanless continued to smile. Do you feel you will shrink?
Shrink, Andy said, and grinned foolishly. Something was happening to him. By God, he was getting high. He was getting off.
Everything will be fine, Wanless said, and smiled more widely. He passed on. Horsemen pass by, Andy thought bemusedly. He looked over at Vicky again. How bright her hair was. For some crazy reason, it reminded him of the copper wire on the armature of a new motor. Generator. Alternator. Flibbertigibbet. He laughed aloud. Smiling slightly as if sharing the joke, the grad assistant crimped the line and injected a little more of the hypo's contents into Andy's arm and strolled away again. Andy could look at the IV line now. It didn't bother him now. I'm a pine tree, he thought. See my beautiful needles? He laughed again. Vicky was smiling at him. God, she was beautiful. He wanted to tell her how beautiful she was, how her hair was like copper set aflame. Thank you, she said. What a nice compliment. Had she said that, or had he imagined it? Grasping the last shreds of his mind, he said, I think I crapped out on the distilled water, Vicky. She said placidly,
me too.
Nice, isn't it?
Nice, she agreed dreamily.
Somewhere, someone was crying, babbling hysterically. The sound rose and fell in interesting cycles. After what seemed like eons of contemplation, Andy turned his head to see what was going on. It was interesting. Everything had become interesting. Everything seemed to be in slow motion. Slow-mo, as the avant-garde campus film critic always put it in his columns. In this film, as in others, Antonioni achieved some of his most spectacular effects with his use of slow-mo footage.
What an interesting, really clever word. It had the sound of a snake slipping out of a refrigerator. Slow-mo.
Several of the grad assistants were running in slow-mo toward one of the cots that had been placed near Room 70's blackboard. The young fellow on the cot appeared to be doing something to his eyes. Yes, he was definitely doing something to his eyes because his fingers were hooked into them, and he seemed to be clawing his eyeballs out of his head. His hands were hooked into claws, and blood was gushing from his eyes. It was gushing in slow-mo. The needle flapped from his arm in slow-mo. Wanless was running in slow-mo. The eyes of the kid on the cot now looked like deflated poached eggs, Andy noted clinically.
Yes, indeedy.
Then the white coats were all gathered around the cot, and you couldn't see the kid anymore. Directly behind him, a chart hung down. It showed the quadrants of the human brain. Andy looked at this with great interest for a while.
Very interesting, as Artie Johnson said on Laugh In.
A bloody hand rose out of the huddle of white coats like the hand of a drowning man. The fingers were streaked with gore and shreds of tissue hung from them. The hand smacked the chart, leaving a blood stain in the shape of a large comma. The chart rattled up on its roller with a smacking sound. Then the cot was lifted. It was still impossible to see the boy who had clawed his eyes out, and carried briskly from the room. A few minutes, hours, days, years later,
One of the grad assistants came over to Andy's cot, examined his drip, and then injected some more Lot 6 into Andy's mind. "How you feeling, guy?" the GA asked, but of course he wasn't a GA. He wasn't a student. None of them were. For one thing, this guy looked about 35, and that was a little long in the tooth for a graduate student. For another, this guy worked for the shop. Andy suddenly knew it. It was absurd, but he knew it. And the man's name was... Andy groped for it, and he got it. The man's name was Ralph Baxter. He smiled. "Ralph Baxter. Good deal." "I feel okay," he said. "How's that other fella?" "What other fella's that, Andy?" "The one who clawed his eyes out," Andy said serenely. Ralph Baxter smiled and patted Andy's hand. "Pretty visual stuff, huh, guy?"
"No, really," Vicky said. "I saw it, too."
"You think you did," the GA, who was not a GA, said. "You just shared the same illusion. There was a guy over there by the board who had a muscular reaction, something like a Charlie horse. No clawed eyes, no blood." He started away again. Andy said, "My man, it is impossible to share the same illusion without some prior consultation." He felt immensely clever. The logic was impeccable, inarguable. He had old Ralph Baxter by the shorts. Ralph smiled back, undaunted. "With this drug, it's very possible," he said. "I'll be back in a bit, okay?" "Okay, Ralph," Andy said. Ralph paused and came back toward where Andy lay on his cot. He came back in slow-mo. He looked thoughtfully down at Andy. Andy grinned back, a wide, foolish, drugged-out grin. "Got you there, Ralph, old son. Got you right by the proverbial shorts." Suddenly, a wealth of information about Ralph Baxter flooded in on him. Tons of stuff. He was 35. He had been with the shop for 6 years. Before that, he'd been with the FBI for 2 years. He had killed 4 people during his career, 3 men and 1 woman. And he had raped the woman after she was dead. She had been an AP stringer, and she had known about... That part wasn't clear. And it didn't matter. Suddenly, Andy didn't want to know. The grin faded from his lips. Ralph Baxter was still looking down at him, and Andy was swept by a black paranoia that he remembered from his 2 previous LSD trips. But this was deeper and much more frightening. He had no idea how he could know such things about Ralph Baxter, or how he had known his name at all, but if he told Ralph that he knew, he was terribly afraid that he might disappear from room 70 of Jason Gearney with the same swiftness as the boy who had clawed his eyes out. Or maybe all of that really had been a hallucination. It didn't seem real at all now. Ralph was still looking at him. Little by little, he began to smile. "See," he said softly, "with Lot 6, all kinds of funky things happen." He laughed. Andy let out a slow sigh of relief. He looked over at Vicky, and she was looking back at him, her eyes wide and frightened. "She's getting your emotions," he thought. "Like a radio. Take it easy on her. Remember, she's tripping, whatever else this weird shit is." He smiled at her, and after a moment, Vicky smiled uncertainly back. She asked him what was wrong. He told her he didn't know. "Probably nothing. But we're not talking. Her mouth's not moving." "It's not? Vicky, is that you? Is it telepathy, Andy? Is it?" He didn't know. It was something. He let his eyes slip closed. "Are those really grad assistants?" she asked him, troubled. "They don't look the same. Is it the drug, Andy?" "I don't know," he said, eyes still closed. "I don't know who they are. What happened to that boy? The one they took away?" He opened his eyes again and looked at her, but Vicky was shaking her head. She didn't remember. Andy was surprised and dismayed to find that he hardly remembered himself. It seemed to have happened years ago. Got a Charlie horse, hadn't he, that guy? A muscular twitch, that's all. He clawed his eyes out. But what did it matter, really? Hand rising out of the huddle of white coats like the hand of a drowning man. But it happened a long time ago, like in the 12th century. Bloody hand striking the chart rattling up on its roller with a smacking sound. Better to drift. Vicky was looking troubled again. Suddenly music began to flood down from the speakers in the ceiling, and that was nice. Much nicer than thinking about Charlie horses and leaking eyeballs. The music was soft and yet majestic. Much later, Andy decided, in consultation with Vicky, that it had been Rachmaninoff. And ever after, when he heard Rachmaninoff, it brought back drifting, dreamy memories of that endless, timeless time in room 70 of Jason Gearney Hall. How much of it had been real? How much hallucination? 12 years of off-and-on thought had not answered that question for Andy McGee. At one point, objects had seemed to fly through the room as if an invisible wind were blowing. Paper cups, towels, a blood pressure cuff, a deadly hail of pens and pencils. At another point, sometime later, or had it really been earlier, there was just no linear sequence, one of the test subjects had gone into a muscular seizure followed by cardiac arrest, or so it had seemed. There had been frantic efforts to restore him using mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, followed by a shot of something directly into the chest cavity, and finally a machine that made a high whine and had two black cups attached to thick wires. And he seemed to remember one of the grad assistants roaring, "Zap him! Zap him! Oh, give them to me, you fuckhead!" At another point he had slept, dozing in and out of a twilight consciousness. He spoke to Vicky, and they told each other about themselves. And he told her about the car accident that had taken his mother's life, and how he had spent the next year with his aunt in a semi-nervous breakdown of grief. She told him that when she was 7, a teenage babysitter had assaulted her, and now she was terribly afraid of sex, even more afraid that she might be frigid. It was that more than anything else that had forced her and her boyfriend to the breakup. He kept pressing her. They told each other things that a man and a woman don't tell each other until they've known each other for years. Things a man and woman often never tell, not even in the dark marriage bed after decades of being together. But did they speak? That Andy never knew. Time had stopped, but somehow it passed anyway. XIII. He came out of the doze a little at a time. The Rachmaninoff was gone, if it had ever been there at all. Vicky was sleeping peacefully on the cot beside him, her hands folded between her breasts, the simple hands of a child who has fallen asleep while offering her bedtime prayers. Andy looked at her and was simply aware that at some point he had fallen in love with her. It was a deep and complete feeling, above and below question. After a while he looked around. Several of the cots were empty. There were maybe 5 test subjects left in the room. Some were sleeping, one was sitting up on his cot, and a grad assistant, a perfectly normal grad assistant of perhaps 25, was questioning him and writing notes on a clipboard. The test subject apparently said something funny, because both of them laughed, in the low, considerate way you do when others around you are sleeping. Andy sat up and took inventory of himself. He felt fine. He tried a smile and found that it fit perfectly. His muscles lay peacefully against one another. He felt eager and fresh, every perception sharply honed and somehow innocent. He could remember feeling this way as a kid, waking up on Saturday morning, knowing his bike was heeled over on its kickstand in the garage, and feeling that the whole weekend stretched ahead of him like a carnival of dreams where every ride was free. One of the grad assistants came over and said, "How you feeling, Andy?" Andy looked at him. This was the same guy that had injected him? When? A year ago? He rubbed a palm over his cheek and heard the rasp of beard stubble. "I feel like Rip Van Winkle," he said. The GA smiled. "It's only been 48 hours, not 20 years. How do you feel, really?" "Fine. Normal?" "Whatever that word means, yes, normal. Where's Ralph?" "Ralph?" The GA raised his eyebrows. "Yes, Ralph Baxter, about 35, big guy, sandy hair." The grad assistant smiled. "You dreamed him up," he said. Andy looked at the GA uncertainly. "I did what?" "Dreamed him up. Hallucinated him. The only Ralph I know who's involved in all the Lot 6 tests in any way is a Darton pharmaceutical rep named Ralph Steinem, and he's 55 or so." Andy looked at the GA for a long time without saying anything. Ralph an illusion? Well, maybe so. It had all the paranoid elements of a dope dream, certainly. Andy seemed to remember thinking Ralph was some sort of secret agent who had wasted all sorts of people. He smiled a little. The GA smiled back. A little too readily, Andy thought. Or was that paranoia, too? Surely it was. The guy who had been sitting up and talking when Andy woke up was now being escorted from the room, drinking from a paper cup of orange juice. Cautiously, Andy said, "No one got hurt, did they?" "Hurt? Well, no one had a convulsion, did they, or..." The grad assistant leaned forward, looking concerned. "Say, Andy, I hope you won't go spreading anything like that around campus. It would play bloody hell with Dr. Wanless's research program. We have Lot 7 and 8 coming up next semester, and..." "Was there anything?" "There was one boy who had a muscular reaction, minor but quite painful," the GA said. "It passed in less than 15 minutes with no harm done, but there's a witch hunt atmosphere around here now. End the draft, ban ROTC, ban Dow Chemical job recruiters because they make napalm. Things get out of proportion, and I happen to think this is pretty important research." "Who was the guy?" "Now, you know I can't tell you that. All I am saying is please remember you were under the influence of a mild hallucinogenic. Don't go mixing up your drug-induced fantasies with reality and then start spreading the combination around." "Would I be allowed to do that?" Andy asked. The GA looked puzzled. "I don't see how we could stop you. Any college experimental program is pretty much at the mercy of its volunteers. For a lousy $200, we can hardly expect you to sign an oath of allegiance, can we?" Andy felt relief. If this guy was lying, he was doing a really superlative job of it. It had all been a series of hallucinations. And on the cot beside his, Vicky was beginning to stir. "Now, what about it?" the GA asked, smiling. "I think I'm supposed to be asking the questions." And he did ask questions. By the time Andy finished answering them, Vicky was fully awake, looking rested and calm and radiant and smiling at him. The questions were detailed. Many of them were the questions Andy himself would have asked. So why did he have the feeling they were all window dressing? Sitting on a couch in one of the smaller union lounges that evening, Andy and Vicky compared hallucinations. She had no memory of the thing that troubled him the most, that bloody hand waving limply above the knot of white tunics, striking the chart and then disappearing. Andy had no recollection of the thing that was most vivid to her. A man with long blonde hair had set up a folding table by her cot so that it was just at her eye level. He had put a row of great big dominoes on the table and said, "Knock them down, Vicky. Knock them all down." And she had raised her hands to push them over, wanting to oblige, and the man had gently but firmly pressed her hands back down on her chest. "You don't need your hands, Vicky," he had said. "Just knock them down." So she had looked at the dominoes, and they had fallen over, one after the other, a dozen or so in all. "It made me feel very tired," she told Andy, smiling that small, slantwise smile of hers. "And I had gotten this idea somehow that we were discussing Vietnam, you know? So I said something like, 'Yes, that proves it. If South Vietnam goes, they all go.' And he smiled and patted my hands and said, 'Why don't you sleep for a while, Vicky? You must be tired.' So I did." She shook her head. "But now it doesn't seem real at all. I think I must have made it up entirely, or built a hallucination around some perfectly normal test. You don't remember seeing him, do you? Tall guy with shoulder-length blonde hair and a little scar on his chin?" Andy shook his head. "But I still don't understand how we could share any of the same fantasies," Andy said. "Unless they've developed a drug over there that's a telepathic as well as an hallucinogenic. I know there's been some talk about it in the last few years. The idea seems to be that if hallucinogens can heighten perception..." He shrugged, then grinned. "Carlos Castaneda, where are you when we need you?" "Isn't it more likely that we just discussed the same fantasy and then forgot we did?" Vicky asked. He agreed it was a strong possibility, but he still felt disquieted by the whole experience. It had been, as they say, a bummer. Taking his courage in his hands, he said, "The only thing I really am sure of is that I seem to be falling in love with you, Vicky." She smiled nervously and kissed the corner of his mouth. "That's sweet, Andy, but..." "But you're a little afraid of me. Of men in general, maybe." "Maybe I am," she said. "All I'm asking for is a chance." "You'll have your chance," she said. "I like you, Andy, a lot, but please remember that I get scared. Sometimes I just get scared." She tried to shrug lightly, but it turned into something like a shudder. "I'll remember," he said.
and drew her into his arms and kissed her. There was a moment's hesitation, and then she kissed him back, holding his hands firmly in hers.
15.
"Daddy!" Charlie screamed.
The world revolved sickly in front of Andy's eyes. The sodium arc lamps lining the northway were below him. The ground was above him and shaking him loose. Then he was on his butt, sliding down the lower half of the embankment like a kid on a slide. Charlie was below him, rolling helplessly over and over. Oh, no, she's going to shoot right out into the traffic. "Charlie!" he yelled hoarsely, hurting his throat, his head. "Watch it!" Then she was down, squatting in the breakdown lane, washed by the harsh lights of a passing car, sobbing. A moment later, he landed beside her with a solid whap that rocketed all the way up his spine to his head. Things doubled in front of his eyes, tripled, and then gradually settled down. Charlie was sitting on her haunches, her head cradled in her arms. "Charlie," he said, touching her arm, "it's all right, honey." "I wish I did go out in front of the cars," she cried out, her voice bright and vicious with a self-loathing that made Andy's heart ache in his chest. "I deserve to for setting that man on fire."
"Shh," he said. "Charlie, you don't have to think of that anymore."
He held her. The cars swashed by them. Any one of them could be a cop, and that would end it. At this point, it would almost be a relief. Her sobs faded off little by little. Part of it, he realized, was simple tiredness. The same thing that was aggravating his headache past the screaming point and bringing this unwelcome flood of memories. If they could only get somewhere and lie down. "Can you get up, Charlie?" She got to her feet slowly, brushing the last of the tears away. Her face was a pallid moonlight in the dark. Looking at her, he felt a sharp lance of guilt. She should be snugly tucked into a bed somewhere in a house with a shrinking mortgage, a teddy bear crooked under one arm, ready to go back to school the next morning and do battle for God, country, and the second grade. Instead, she was standing in the breakdown lane of a turnpike spur in upstate New York at 1:15 in the morning, on the run, consumed with guilt because she had inherited something from her mother and father, something she herself had had no more part in determining than the direct blue of her eyes. How do you explain to a 7-year-old girl that Daddy and Mommy had once needed $200, and the people they had talked to said it was all right, but they had lied? "We're going to hook us a ride," Andy said, and he couldn't tell if he had slung his arm around her shoulders to comfort her or to support himself. "We'll get to a hotel or a motel and we'll sleep. Then we'll think about what to do next. That sound all right?" Charlie nodded listlessly. "Okay," he said, and cocked his thumb. The cars rushed by it, unheeding, and less than 2 miles away the green car was on its way again. Andy knew nothing of this. His harried mind had turned back to that night with Vicky in the Union. She was staying at one of the dorms, and he had dropped her off there, relishing her lips again on the step just outside the big double doors, and she had put her arms hesitantly around his neck, this girl who had still been a virgin. They had been young. Jesus, they had been young. The cars rushed by. Charlie's hair lifted and dropped in each backwash of air, and he remembered the rest of what had happened that night 12 years ago. 16. Andy started across campus after seeing Vicky into her dorm, headed for the highway where he would hitch a ride into town. Although he could feel it only faintly against his face, the May wind beat strongly through the elms lining the mall, as if an invisible river ran through the air just above him, a river from which he could detect only the faintest, farthest ripples. Jason Gearney Hall was on his way, and he stopped in front of its dark bulk. Around it, the trees with their new foliage danced sinuously in the unseen current of that river of wind. A cool chill wormed its way down his spine and then settled in his stomach, freezing him lightly. He shivered even though the evening was warm. A big silver dollar moon rode between the growing rafts of clouds, gilded keelboats running before the wind, running on that dark river of air. The moonlight reflected on the building's windows, making them glare like blankly unpleasant eyes. "Something happened in there," he thought. "Something more than what we were told or led to expect. What was it?" In his mind's eye, he saw that drowning, bloody hand again. Only this time he saw it striking the chart, leaving a bloodstain in the shape of a comma, and then the chart rolling up with a rattling, smacking sound.
He walked toward the building.
Crazy. They're not going to let you into a lecture hall at past 10 o'clock, and I'm scared.
Yes, that was it. Too many disquieting half-memories. Too easy to persuade himself they had only been fantasies. Vicky was already on her way to accomplishing that. A test subject clawing his eyes out. Someone screaming that she wished she were dead. That being dead would be better than this, even if it meant going to hell and burning there for eternity. Someone else going into cardiac arrest and then being bundled out of sight with chilling professionalism.
Because, let's face it, Andy, old kid, thinking about telepathy doesn't scare you. What scares you is the thought that one of those things might have happened.
Heels clicking, he walked up to the big double doors and tried them.
Locked. Behind them he could see the empty lobby. Andy knocked, and when he saw someone coming out of the shadows, he almost ran. He almost ran because the face that was going to appear out of those swimming shadows would be the face of Ralph Baxter, or of a tall man with shoulder-length blonde hair and a scar on his chin. But it was neither. The man who came over to the lobby doors and unlocked them and stuck his querulous face out was a typical college security guard, about 62, lined cheeks and forehead, wary blue eyes that were rheumy from too much bottle time. A big-time clock was clipped to his belt.
"Building's closed," he said.
"I know," Andy said, "but I was part of an experiment in room 70 that finished up this morning, and..."
"That don't matter. Building closes at 9 on weeknights. Come back tomorrow."
"And I think I left my watch in there," Andy said.
He didn't own a watch.
"Hey, what do you say, just one quick look around?"
"I can't do that," the night man said, but all at once he sounded strangely unsure.
With no thought at all about it one way or another, Andy said in a low voice,
"Sure you can. I'll just take a look, and then I'll be out of your way. You won't even remember I was here, right?"
A sudden weird feeling in his head. It was as if he had reached out and pushed this elderly night security man, only with his head instead of his hands. And the guard did take 2 or 3 uncertain steps backwards, letting go of the door. Andy stepped in, a little concerned. There was a sudden sharp pain in his head, but it subsided to a low throb that was gone half an hour later.
"Say, are you all right?" he asked the security man.
Sure, I'm okay."
The security man's suspicion was gone. He gave Andy a smile that was entirely friendly.
"Go on up and look for your watch if you want to. Take your time. I probably won't even remember that you're here."
And he strolled off. Andy looked after him disbelievingly and then rubbed his forehead absently as if to soothe the mild ache there. What in God's name had he done to that old duck? Something, that was for sure. He turned, went to the stairs, and began climbing them. The upper hall was deeply shadowed and narrow. A nagging feeling of claustrophobia slipped around him and seemed to tighten his breathing like an invisible dog collar. Up here, the building had poked into that river of wind, and the air went skating under the eaves, screaming thinly. Room 70 had 2 double doors, the top halves 2 squares of frosted pebbled glass. Andy stood outside them, listening to the wind move through the old gutters and downspouts, rattling the rusty leaves of dead years. His heart was thudding heavily in his chest. He almost walked away from it then. It seemed suddenly easier not to know, just to forget it. Then he reached out and grasped one of the doorknobs, telling himself there was nothing to worry about anyway because the damn room would be locked and good riddance to it. Except that it wasn't. The knob turned freely. The door opened. The room was empty, lit only by stuttering moonlight through the moving branches of the old elms outside. There was enough light for him to see that the cots had been removed. The blackboard had been erased and washed. The chart was rolled up like a window shade, only the pull ring dangling. Andy stepped toward it, and after a moment he reached up with a hand that trembled slightly and pulled it down. Quadrants of the brain. The human mind served up and marked like a butcher's diagram. Just seeing it made him get that trippy feeling again, like an acid flash. Nothing fun about it. It was sickening, and a moan escaped his throat, as delicate as a silver strand of spider web. The bloodstain was there, comma black in the moon's uneasy light. A printed legend that had undoubtedly read Corpus Callosum before this weekend's experiment now read Cor Osum, the comma-shaped stain intervening. Such a small thing. Such a huge thing. He stood in the dark looking at it, starting to shake for real.
How much of it did this make true?
Some? Most? All? None of the above? From behind him he heard a sound, or thought he did, the stealthy squeak of a shoe. His hands jerked, and one of them struck the chart with that same awful smacking sound. It rattled back up on its roller, the sound dreadfully loud in this black pit of a room. A sudden knocking on the moonlight-dusted far window. A branch, or perhaps dead fingers, streaked with gore and tissue. Let me in. I left my eyes in there. Oh, let me in. Let me in. He whirled in a slow-motion dream, a slow-mo dream, sinkingly sure that it would be that boy, a spirit in a white robe, dripping black holes where his eyes had been. His heart was a live thing in his throat. No one there. No thing there. But his nerve was broken, and when the branch began its implacable knocking again, he fled, not bothering to close the classroom door behind him. He sprinted down the narrow corridor, and suddenly footfalls were pursuing him, echoes of his own running feet. He went down the stairs two at a time, and so came back into the lobby, breathing hard, the blood hammering at his temples, the air in his throat prickled like cut hay. He didn't see the security man anywhere about. He left, shutting one of the big glass lobby doors behind him, and slinking down the walk to the quad like the fugitive he would later become. XVII. 5 days later, and much against her will, Andy dragged Vicky Tomlinson down to Jason Gearney Hall. She had already decided she never wanted to think about the experiment again. She had drawn her $200 check from the psychology department, banked it, and wanted to forget where it had come from. He persuaded her to come using eloquence he hadn't been aware he possessed. They went at the 2:50 change of classes. The bells of Harrison Chapel played a carillon in the dozing May air. "Nothing can happen to us in broad daylight," he said, uneasily refusing to clarify, even in his own mind, exactly what he might be afraid of. "Not with dozens of people all around." "I just don't want to go, Andy," she had said, but she had gone. There were two or three kids leaving the lecture room with books under their arms. Sunshine painted the windows a prosier hue than the diamond dust of moonlight, Andy remembered. As Andy and Vicky entered, a few others trickled in for their 3 o'clock biology seminar. One of them began to talk softly and earnestly to a pair of the others about an end ROTC march that was coming off that weekend. No one took the slightest notice of Andy and Vicky. "All right," Andy said, and his voice was thick and nervous. "See what you think." He pulled the chart down by the dangling ring. They were looking at a naked man with his skin flayed away and his organs labeled. His muscles looked like interwoven skeins of red yarn. Some wit had labeled him Oscar the Grouch. "Jesus," Andy said. She gripped his arm and her hand was warm with nervous perspiration. "Andy," she said, "please, let's go, before someone recognizes us." Yes, he was ready to go. The fact that the chart had been changed somehow scared him more than anything else. He jerked the pull ring down sharply and let it go. It made that same smacking sound as it went up. Different chart, same sound. 12 years later, he could still hear the sound it made when his aching head would let him. He never stepped into room 70 of Jason Gearney Hall after that day, but he was acquainted with that sound. He heard it frequently in his dreams, and saw that questing, drowning, blood-stained hand. 18. The green car whispered along the airport feeder road toward the Northway entrance ramp. Behind the wheel, Norville Bates sat with his hands firmly at 10 and 2 o'clock. Classical music came from the FM receiver in a muted, smooth flow. His hair was now short and combed back, but the small, semicircular scar on his chin hadn't changed, the place where he had cut himself on a jagged piece of Coke bottle as a kid. Vicky, had she still been alive, would have recognized him. "We have one unit on the way," the man in the Botany 500 suit said. His name was John Mayo. "The guy's a stringer. He works for DIA as well as us." "Just an ordinary whore," the third man said, and all three of them laughed in a nervous, keyed-up way. They knew they were close. They could almost smell blood. The name of the third man was Orville Jameson, but he preferred to be called O.J., or even better, the Juice. He signed all his office memos O.J. He had signed one the Jews, and that bastard Cap had given him a reprimand. Not just an oral one, a written one that had gone on his record. "You think it's the North Way, huh?" O.J. asked. Norval Bates shrugged. "Either the North Way or they headed into Albany," he said. "I gave the local yokel the hotels in town because it's his town, right?" "Right," John Mayo said. He and Norval got along well together. They went back a long way, all the way back to room 70 of Jason Gearney Hall, and that, my friend, should anyone ever ask you, had been hairy. John never wanted to go through anything that hairy again. He had been the man who zapped the kid who went into cardiac arrest. He had been a medic during the early days in Nam, and he knew what to do with the defibrillator, in theory, at least. In practice, it hadn't gone so well, and the kid had got away from them. 12 kids got lot 6 that day. 2 of them had died. The kid who had gone into cardiac arrest, and a girl who died 6 days later in her dorm, apparently of a sudden brain embolism. 2 others had gone hopelessly insane. One of them, the boy who had blinded himself. The other, a girl who later developed a total paralysis from the neck down. Wanless had said that was psychological, but who the fuck knew? It had been a nice day's work, all right. "The local yokel is taking his wife along," Norval was saying. "She's looking for her granddaughter. Her son ran away with the little girl. Nasty divorce case, all of that. She doesn't want to notify the police unless she has to, but she's afraid the son might be going mental. If she plays it right, there isn't a night clerk in town that won't tell her if the two of them have checked in." "If she plays it right," O.J. said, "with these stringers you can never tell." John said, "We're going to the closest on-ramp, right?" "Right," Norval said. "Just 3-4 minutes now." "Have they had enough time to get down there?" "They have if they were busting ass. Maybe we'll be able to pick them up trying to thumb a ride right there on the ramp, or maybe they took a shortcut and went over the side into the breakdown lane. Either way, all we have to do is cruise along until we come to them." "Where you headed, buddy? Hop in," the Jew said and laughed. There was a .357 Magnum in a shoulder holster under his left arm. He called it the Windsucker. "If they already hooked them a ride, we're shit out of luck, Norv," John said. Norville shrugged. "Percentage play. It's 1:15 in the morning. With the rationing, traffic's thinner than ever. What's Mr. Businessman going to think if he sees a big guy and a little girl trying to hitch a ride?" "He's going to think it's bad news," John said. "That's a big 10-4. The juice laughed again. Up ahead, the stop-and-go light that marked the Northway ramp gleamed in the dark. O.J. put his hand on the walnut stock of the Windsucker. Just in case. The van passed them by, backwashing cool air, and then its brake lights flashed brighter and it swerved over into the breakdown lane about 50 yards farther up. "Thank God," Andy said softly. "You let me do the talking, Charlie." "All right, Daddy." She sounded apathetic. The dark circles were back under her eyes. The van was backing up as they walked toward it. Andy's head felt like a slowly swelling lead balloon. There was a vision from the 1001 Nights painted on the side. Caliphs, maidens hiding under gauzy masks, a carpet floating mystically in the air. The carpet was undoubtedly meant to be red, but in the light of the turnpike sodiums it was the dark maroon of drying blood. Andy opened the passenger door and boosted Charlie up and in. He followed her. "Thanks, mister," he said. "Saved our lives." "My pleasure," the driver said. "Hi, little stranger."
"Hi,"
Charlie said in a small voice. The driver checked the outside mirror, drove down the breakdown lane at a steadily increasing pace, and then crossed into the travel lane. Glancing past Charlie's slightly bowed head, Andy felt a touch of guilt. The driver was exactly the sort of young man Andy himself always passed by when he saw him standing on the shoulder with his thumb out. Big but lean, he wore a heavy black beard that curled down to his chest, and a big felt hat that looked like a prop in a movie about feudin' Kentucky hillbillies. A cigarette that looked home-rolled was cocked in the corner of his mouth, curling up smoke. Just a cigarette, by the smell, no sweet odor of cannabis.
"Where you headed, my man?" the driver asked.
2 towns up the line," Andy said.
"Hastings Glen?"
"That's right." The driver nodded.
"On the run from someone, I guess."
Charlie tensed, and Andy put a soothing hand on her back and rubbed gently until she loosened up again. He had detected no menace in the driver's voice.
"There was a process server at the airport," he said.
The driver grinned. It was almost hidden beneath his fierce beard, plucked the cigarette from his mouth and offered it delicately to the wind sucking just outside his half-open vent window. The slipstream gulped it down.
"Something to do with the little stranger here is my guess," he said.
"Not far wrong," Andy said. The driver fell silent. Andy settled back and tried to cope with his headache. It seemed to have leveled off at a final screaming pitch. Had it ever been this bad before? Impossible to tell. Each time he overdid it, it seemed like the worst ever. It would be a month before he dared use the push again. He knew that two towns up the line was not nearly far enough, but it was all he could manage tonight. He was tipped over. Hastings Glen would have to do.
"Who do you pick, man?" the driver asked him.
"Huh?
The series, the San Diego Padres in the World Series. How do you figure that?"
"Pretty far out," Andy agreed. His voice came from far away, a tolling undersea bell.
"You okay, man? You look pale."
"A headache," Andy said. "Migraine."
"Too much pressure," the driver said. "I can dig it. You staying at a hotel? You need some cash? I could let you have 5. Wish it was more, but I'm on my way to California, and I gotta watch it careful. Just like the Jodes and the Grapes of Wrath."
Andy smiled gratefully. I think we're okay."
"Fine." He glanced at Charlie, who had dozed off. "Pretty little girl, my man. Are you watching out for her?"
"As best I can," Andy said.
"All right," the driver said. "That's the name of that tune."
20.
Hastings Glen was little more than a wide place in the road. At this hour, all the traffic lights in town turned to blinkers. The bearded driver in the hillbilly hat took them up the exit ramp, through the sleeping town and down Route 40 to the Slumberland Motel, a redwood place with the skeletal remains of a harvested cornfield in back, and a pinkish-red neon sign out front that stuttered the non-word V-A-C into the dark. As her sleep deepened, Charlie had tilted farther and farther to the left until her head was resting on the driver's blue jean thigh. Andy had offered to shift her, and the driver shook his head.
"She's fine, man. Let her sleep."
"Would you mind dropping us off a little bit past?" Andy asked. It was hard to think, but this caution came almost intuitively.
"Don't want the night man to know you don't have a car?"
The driver smiled.
"Sure, man, but a place like that, they wouldn't give a squirt if you pedaled in on a unicycle."
The van's tires crunched the gravel shoulder.
"You positive you couldn't use 5?
"I guess I could," Andy said reluctantly. "Would you write down your address for me? I'll mail it back to you." The driver's grin reappeared.
"My address is in transit," he said, getting out his wallet.
"But you may see my happy smiling face again, right?"
"Who knows? Grab on to Abe, man."
He handed the 5 to Andy, and suddenly Andy was crying. Not a lot, but crying.
"No, man," the driver said kindly.
He touched the back of Andy's neck lightly.
"Life is short and pain is long, and we were all put on this earth to help each other. The comic book philosophy of Jim Paulson in a nutshell. Take good care of the little stranger."
"Sure," Andy said, brushing his eyes. He put the $5 bill in the pocket of his corduroy coat.
"Charlie, hon, wake up. Just a little bit longer now."
21. 3 minutes later, Charlie was leaning sleepily against him while he watched Jim Paulson go up the road to a closed restaurant, turn around, and then head back past them toward the interstate. Andy raised his hand. Paulson raised his in return. Old Ford van with the Arabian Nights on the side, gins and grand viziers, and a mystic floating carpet. "Hope California's good to you, guy," Andy thought, and then the two of them walked back toward the Slumberland Motel.
"I want you to wait for me outside and out of sight," Andy said.
"Okay?"
"Okay, Daddy."
"Very sleepy."
He left her by an evergreen shrub and walked over to the office and rang the night bell. After about 2 minutes, a middle-aged man in a bathrobe appeared, polishing his glasses. He opened the door and let Andy in without a word.
"I wonder if I could have the unit down on the end of the left wing," Andy said. "I parked there."
"This time of year you could have all of the West Wing if you wanted it," the night man said, and smiled around a mouthful of yellow dentures. He gave Andy a printed index card and a pen advertising business supplies.
A car passed by outside.
silent headlights that waxed and waned. Andy signed the card Bruce Rosell. Bruce was driving a 1978 Vega, New York license LMS-240. He looked at the blank-marked organization company for a moment, and then, in a flash of inspiration, as much as his aching head would allow, he wrote United Vending Company of America and checked cash under form of payment. Another car went by out front. The clerk initialed the card and tucked it away. "That's $17.50. "Do you mind change?" Andy asked. "I never did get a chance to cash up, and I'm dragging around 20 pounds of silver. I hate these country milk runs." "Spends just as easy. I don't mind." "Thanks." Andy reached into his coat pocket, pushed aside the $5 bill with his fingers, and brought out a fistful of quarters, nickels, and dimes. He counted out $14, brought out some more change, and made up the rest. The clerk had been separating the coins into neat piles, and now he swept them into the correct compartments of the cash drawer. "You know," he said, closing the drawer and looking at Andy hopefully, "I'd knock $5 off your room bill if you could fix my cigarette machine. It's been out of order for a week." Andy walked over to the machine, which stood in the corner, pretended to look at it, and then walked back. "Not our brand," he said. "Oh, shit. Okay. Good night, buddy. You'll find an extra blanket on the closet shelf if you should want it." "Fine." He went out. The gravel crunched beneath his feet, hideously amplified in his ears, sounding like stone cereal. He walked over to the evergreen shrub where he had left Charlie, and Charlie wasn't there. "Charlie?" No answer. He switched the room key on its long green plastic tab from one hand to the other. Both hands were suddenly sweaty. "Charlie?" Still no answer. He thought back, and now it seemed to him that the car that had gone past when he had been filling out the registration card had been slowing down. Maybe it had been a green car. His heartbeat began to pick up, sending jolts of pain up to his skull. He tried to think what he should do if Charlie was gone, but he couldn't think. His head hurt too badly. There was a low, snorting, snoring sound from deeper back in the bushes, a sound he knew very well. He leaped toward it, gravel spurting out from under his shoes. Stiff evergreen branches scraped his legs and raked back the tails of his corduroy jacket. Charlie was lying on her side on the verge of the motel lawn, knees drawn up nearly to her chin, hands between them, fast asleep. Andy stood with his eyes closed for a moment and then shook her awake for what he hoped would be the last time that night, that long, long night. Her eyelids fluttered, and then she was looking up at him. "Daddy?" she asked. Her voice was blurred, still half in her dreams. "I got out of sight, like you said." "I know, honey," he said. "I know you did. Come on. We're going to bed."
22. 20 minutes later, they were both in the double bed of Unit 16, Charlie fast asleep and breathing evenly, Andy still awake but drifting toward sleep, only the steady thump in his head still holding him up, and the questions. They had been on the run for about a year. It was almost impossible to believe, maybe because it hadn't seemed so much like running, not when they had been in Port City, Pennsylvania, running the weight-off program. Charlie had gone to school in Port City, and how could you be on the run if you were holding a job and your daughter was going to first grade? They had almost been caught in Port City, not because they had been particularly good, although they were terribly dogged, and that frightened Andy a lot, but because Andy had made that crucial lapse. He had allowed himself temporarily to forget they were fugitives. No chance of that now. How close were they? Still back in New York? If only he could believe that. They hadn't got the cabbie's number. They were still tracking him down. More likely, they were in Albany, crawling over the airport like maggots over a pile of meat scraps. Hastings Glen? Maybe by morning, but maybe not. Hastings Glen was 15 miles from the airport. No need to let paranoia sweep away good sense. I deserve it. I deserve to go in front of the cars for setting that man on fire. His own voice replying, "It could have been worse. It could have been his face." Voices in a haunted room. Something else came to him. He was supposed to be driving a Vega. When morning came and the nightman didn't see a Vega parked in front of Unit 16, would he just assume his United Vending Company man had pushed on? Or would he investigate? Nothing he could do about it now. He was totally wasted.
I thought there was something funny about him. He looked pale, sick, and he paid with change. He said he worked for a vending machine company, but he couldn't fix the cigarette machine in the lobby.
Voices in a haunted room. He shifted onto his side, listening to Charlie's slow, even breathing. He thought they had taken her, but she'd only gone farther back in the bushes, out of sight. Charlene Roberta McGee. Charlie, since forever. If they took you, Charlie, I don't know what I'd do.
XXIII. One last voice. His roommate Quincy's voice from 6 years ago. Charlie had been a year old then, and of course they knew she wasn't normal. They had known that since she was a week old, and Vicky had brought her into their bed with them, because when she was left in the little crib, the pillow began to, began to smolder. The night they had put the crib away forever, not speaking in their fright. A fright too big and too strange to be articulated, it had got hot enough to blister her cheek, and she had screamed most of the night, in spite of the solar cane Andy had found in the medicine chest. What a crazy house that first year had been. No sleep, endless fear, fires in the wastebaskets when her bottles were late. Once the curtains had burst into flame, and if Vicky hadn't been in the room, it was her fall down the stairs that had finally prompted him to call Quincy. She had been crawling then, and was quite good at going up the stairs on her hands and knees and then backing down again the same way. Andy had been sitting with her that day. Vicky was out at Centers with one of her friends, shopping. She had been hesitant about going, and Andy nearly had to throw her out the door. She was looking too used lately, too tired. There was something scary in her eyes that made him think about those combat fatigue stories you heard during wartime. He'd been reading in the living room near the foot of the stairs. Charlie was going up and down. Sitting on the stairs was a teddy bear. He should have moved it, of course, but each time she went up, Charlie went around it, and he had become lulled, much as he had become lulled by what appeared to be their normal life in Port City. As she came down the third time, her feet got tangled around the bear, and she came all the way to the bottom, thump, bump, and tumble, wailing with rage and fear. The stairs were carpeted, and she didn't even have a bruise. God watches over drunks and small children, that had been Quincy's saying, and that was his first conscious thought of Quincy that day. But Andy rushed to her, picked her up, held her, cooed a lot of nonsense to her while he gave her a quick once-over, looking for blood, or a limb hanging wrong, signs of concussion, and he felt it pass him, the invisible, incredible bolt of death from his daughter's mind. It felt like the backwash of warm air from a high-bawling subway train, when it's summertime and you're standing maybe a little too close on the platform, a soft, soundless passage of warm air. And then the teddy bear was on fire. Teddy had hurt Charlie. Charlie would hurt Teddy. The flames roared up, and for a moment, as it charred, Andy was looking at its black shoe-button eyes through a sheet of flame, and the flames were spreading to the carpeting on the stairs where the bear had tumbled. Andy put his daughter down and ran for the fire extinguisher on the wall near the TV. He and Vicky didn't talk about the thing their daughter could do. There were times when Andy wanted to, but Vicky wouldn't hear of it. She avoided the subject with hysterical stubbornness, saying there was nothing wrong with Charlie, nothing wrong. But fire extinguishers had appeared silently, undiscussed, with almost the same stealth as dandelions appear during that period when spring and summer overlap. They didn't talk about what Charlie could do, but there were fire extinguishers all over the house. He grabbed this one, smelling the heavy aroma of frying carpet, and dashed for the stairs. And still there was time to think about that story, the one he had read as a kid. It's a Good Life, by some guy named Jerome Bixby. And that had been about a little kid who enslaved his parents with psychic terror, a nightmare of a thousand possible deaths, and you never knew when the little kid was going to get mad. Charlie was wailing, sitting on her butt at the foot of the stairs. Andy twisted the knob on the fire extinguisher savagely and sprayed foam on the spreading fire, dousing it. He picked up Teddy, his fur stippled with dots and puffs and dollops of foam, and carried him back downstairs. Hating himself, yet knowing in some primitive way that it had to be done, the line had to be drawn, the lesson learned, he jammed the bear almost into Charlie's screaming, frightened, tear-streaked face. "Oh, you dirty bastard," he had thought desperately. "Why don't you just go out to the kitchen and get a paring knife and cut a line up each cheek, mark her that way?" And his mind had seized on that. Scars. Yes.
That's what he had to do, scar his child, burn a scar on her soul. "Do you like the way Teddy looks?" he roared. The bear was scalded, the bear was blackened, and in his hand it was still as warm as a cooling lump of charcoal. "Do you like Teddy to be all burned so you can't play with him anymore, Charlie?"